You may be seated. Our third case is 13-1671 and 13-1795, Infinite Security Solutions versus Carum Properties Limited. For the appellant, Mr. Eklund.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is Paul Eklund, and I represent Travelers Indemnity Company. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This court said in Spursel versus Sterling Industries that public policy favors settlements. And in that same case, this court indicated that public policy favors termination of disputes, timely termination of disputes. This court laid down a general rule of law in Mack versus Polson Rubber Company when it recognized that a court has inherent power to enforce settlement agreements. And in State X Rel Rice versus McGrath, this court said that the exception to that general rule occurs when a court unconditionally dismisses the lawsuit, in which case it loses all jurisdiction over the case. Travelers is asking this court to apply this court's pronouncements on public policy and on the inherent power of a trial court to narrowly define the scope of the unconditional dismissal exception. What Travelers is asking this court to do is to follow the practice of those appellate courts giving deference to a trial court's inherent power by holding that a dismissal entry does not become unconditional simply because it does not embody the terms of a settlement agreement or specifically reserve to the court the right of continuing jurisdiction.
Mr. Eklund, in this case, the matter was dismissed without prejudice.
That's correct.
What does that mean to you?
That was one of the bases upon which the Sixth District put a lot of emphasis in giving its decision. The Sixth District said that dismissal without prejudice means that it's as if the case was never filed, and that therefore the court loses all jurisdiction over the case. But this court said in Page versus Riley that that's not necessarily true. In Page versus Riley, this court addressed a settlement dismissal entry, which stated that, and I'm going to quote, the case is dismissed other than on the merits and without prejudice. As was true in our case, in the Page case, the dismissal entry contemplated future action. In Page, the dismissal entry indicated that the parties had a right to file a motion to reactivate the case within, 180 days of the termination of the federal bankruptcy court stay that formed the basis for the dismissal. This court found that the trial court had the power to reactivate the case, and therefore found that the dismissal entry, which was without prejudice, was unconditional.
Is it reactivation of a case, or is it the filing of a new case if there's a dismissal without prejudice?
In Page, it was the reactivation of the case.
So same case number.
I'm sorry?
The same case number.
The same
judge, is that what you're saying?
Yes, it went back to the same judge.
Was it the same case number as a reactivation would be?
Yes, it was. Because what the court said in Page was that the case could be reactivated. The court had reactivated the case upon motion of the parties. That was challenged. And this court said that, no, the court had the power to proceed to reactivate the case.
But in the ordinary dismissal without prejudice and with, obviously, with the ability to refile. A refiling usually gives a new case number, does it not?
That's correct. It's a new lawsuit. And that's the problem in this case. By forcing the parties to file a new lawsuit to enforce the settlement agreement, the rule essentially is imposing upon the parties additional costs in filing of the new lawsuit, an additional burden on the courts because it goes in front of a new judge who's unfamiliar with the dispute, and it also delays resolution of the dispute between the parties.
But the settlement agreement that you're talking about was not part of the entry, and the court has nothing to enforce. Had it been attached, had it been journalized, had it been spread on the record, there would be something the court could do to enforce. But in this case, because it was dismissed without prejudice, what does the court have to enforce?
There was a settlement agreement. And I think the record in the case very clearly shows.
But there are all sorts of agreements that parties make all the time. And the enforcement mechanism is between the parties who make those agreements. It's not for the court to enforce something that isn't before it.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. If you look at the rule in the four appellate districts that would find the certified question in this case in the negative, you're going to find that simply saying a case is settled and dismissed, something that references or alludes to the existence of a settlement agreement, indicates that the court is aware that there's an agreement between the parties. And I submit that under Mack versus Polson Rubber Company, since the court has the inherent power to enforce settlement agreements, referencing or alluding to the existence of the settlement agreement means that it can be able to enforce the settlement agreement, regardless of whether it's filed as a matter of course on the record or not.
Did either party request that the settlement agreement be part of the entry?
No, because in this case, Your Honor, what happened was there was a settlement on May 19th of 2011. In the court on May 26th of 2011, sua sponte issued the dismissal entry that's the subject of this case, which said that basically the parties having represented to the court that their differences have been resolved, this case is dismissed without prejudice, parties having the right to refile a final entry within 30 days. The court didn't give the parties the opportunity to weigh in on what language should be included in the sua sponte dismissal. I think in the dismissal, though, because the entry clearly said parties having represented to the court that their differences have been resolved, the trial court was well aware that a settlement agreement had been reached between the parties. And it's clear that it dismissed the case based upon that premise because it said this case is dismissed immediately after referencing the fact that the parties had resolved their differences.
But then
there was a suggestion here that the dismissal was in part due to the court's reporting requirements. Is that correct?
There was that suggestion in the brief of appellee. I have no knowledge as to whether that's true. I would suggest that
What month did it take place in?
The dismissal took place in the month of May.
Okay.
I would suggest that if that is a concern, that should be addressed by this court in the rules of superintendence and not under case law.
How old was the case?
The case was filed in 2009, I believe.
And this was 2011?
11, correct.
Okay, so it was less than 2 years old.
My understanding.
All right, so that shouldn't have been an issue here. But let me ask you, you were given the option to supplement the dismissal with an order within 30 days.
Correct.
Nobody did that.
Nobody did it, Your Honor, because what happened, the settlement agreement between the parties was that Carum and Travelers would attempt to agree upon the priority to the settlement amount being paid by Infinite. They represented to the court, we're going to try to work it out. But if we can't,
see who's going to get paid first and
right,
what amount.
We'll come back to the court and ask the trial court to declare who gets the money.
Well, wait a minute. That was the original intent? We're going to go back to the court to determine who gets the money?
The settlement agreement was, we'll try to figure it out.
Right.
And if we can't, yes, we're going to go back to the court and ask the court to tell us who gets the money.
And you knew that there was a 30-day deadline there?
Correct.
Why didn't you... What kind of diligence was exercised during those 30 days to get the case resolved?
There was negotiation between the parties which broke down, and it became apparent that there wasn't going to be an agreement.
Within those 30 days?
Correct, which is when Travelers then filed a motion to set aside the dismissal.
Okay.
So that the court could take up the issue of who gets priority to the settlement funds.
Okay.
That was a motion to set aside, I think was the way it was captioned in the trial court.
What about the local rule, 5.05F, that says if the settlement is not memorialized within 30 days, the court may dismiss the case?
And in this case, I would submit that the court actually jumped the gun, because it filed its dismissal entry sua sponte 7 days after it was advised that a settlement agreement had been reached. At that point, it had dismissed the case without prejudice, right to file within 30 days. We couldn't file because there was no agreement. So trial counsel at the time did what they thought was best, moved to vacate the judgment to get the issue back in front of the trial court.
Counsel, Travelers also filed a motion to set aside the judgment, correct?
That's what they filed after the negotiations broke down. That's correct.
Okay. Couldn't the, and the court denied that?
The court found it to be moot.
But couldn't, on remand, the trial court could grant it, could it not?
Grant the motion to set aside? Basically a 60B type motion? Mm-hmm. Yes, the court could.
And isn't that always possible in a situation like this? A 60B, perhaps?
I'd like to say yes. It's not always possible because there's a body of case law talking about whether or not a court has jurisdiction if there's a dismissal without prejudice.
So possible, but maybe not practical.
Possible, maybe not. There's also a body of case law that talks about the parties being able to file to vacate a judgment if it's believed that the judgment was entered improperly. But again, that's up to the trial court discretion as to whether or not they're going to grant it. In this situation, what we're trying to do is avoid having to go file a new lawsuit, which could be the result if the court says, no, I know what I did, and that's what I wanted to do.
Can you articulate, this is always Justice O'Donnell's question, but can you articulate the remedy that you really want here?
Sure.
I think in your reply, you say that you don't disagree that you could have a judgment entry that says it can either incorporate the settlement. You don't want it to require to incorporate the settlement.
Right.
Talk about what kind of entry are you looking for here? What bright line are you asking for?
What I'm asking this court to do is adopt a rule that's followed by the 5th District, the 8th District, the 11th District, and the 12th District, which is that if a dismissal entry references or alludes to the existence of a settlement agreement upon which the dismissal is based, that the entry is not unconditional. The court then retains jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement. I think that's our bottom line.
If it alludes to a settlement agreement,
yes,
then it is still alive until what happens?
Until the final entry is filed, saying that the case is dismissed in total, or that there is no resurrection of the case in order to enforce the settlement agreement.
For how long?
Up until the expiration of the statute of limitations on contracts.
So you want to have a dismissal entry that says there's a settlement agreement out there someplace, and this court is going to retain jurisdiction over this case until we're notified that the parties have crossed their T's and dot their I's and paid their dollars. Is that correct?
Well,
or the statute of limitation passes, but the statute of limitations has not already been met by the filing of the lawsuit. Why would that enter into it?
Well, Your Honor, I'd like you to consider the fact that if the rule that the Sixth District applied here, that the dismissal entry embodied the terms of the settlement agreement, and let's say that the settlement agreement required the parties to make periodic payments for 20 years. The bottom line is, even under that scenario, advocated by the Sixth District, the parties would still have the right to come back to the court to enforce the settlement agreement, as long as under their terms, the dismissal entry either—
That would be a different case, though. They wouldn't come back under the original case number to enforce that settlement agreement.
I believe they would, because as I understand the rule in the Sixth District and now in the Sixth District, the rule is that if the dismissal entry embodies the term of the settlement agreement, or it specifically reserves to the court the jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement, that continues on until the settlement is consummated.
Okay, but that very specific language has to be in the settlement agreement that you would agree to ongoing jurisdiction in the event future payments are missed or not made.
And what I'm saying is I don't believe that's necessary because I think this court has already indicated, look, the trial court has the inherent power to enforce a settlement agreement. The unconditional dismissal rule is an exception to that general rule of law that the court has the power. What I'm saying is we should narrow the exception and recognize the power, the inherent power of the trial court to affect settlements.
Well, counsel, there's a split in the jurisdictions here in Ohio, correct?
That's correct.
It sounds to me like you're speaking from Cuyahoga County and we're up in Toledo here. And that's Cuyahoga County, as I understand it, is saying if it mentions there is a settlement agreement, that's enough.
If it alludes to or references a settlement agreement, yes, that's sufficient.
But in this case, there is no reference to the terms of the settlement agreement, correct?
That's correct, nor is there in any of the four districts which recognize the rule.
And isn't that because counsel is expected to provide an entry that will set forth the settlement terms? I mean, isn't that what the local rule says under 505? You've got 30 days. When you tell us we have a settlement, you have 30 days to reduce it to writing and provide it to the court.
I do not believe that it's contemplated under the local rule that the final entry has to embody the terms of a settlement agreement. In fact, that would run contrary to public policy favoring settlements because oftentimes, as was the case in this situation, the parties don't want public disclosure of the settlement terms for fear that it'll foster lawsuits against the obligated party.
Well, you certainly can write in confidential portions of your settlement agreement, but isn't part of the reason that you reduce it to writing is that you actually come to an agreement that is going to be enforceable by the court? That seems to be encouraging settlement.
I would agree. Reducing it to writing allows it to be enforced by the court. What we're talking about, I believe your question, is whether or not that agreement then has to be filed with the court. And I don't believe any court of appeals has held that that's absolutely necessary. What they've said, even the most broad view of the unconditional dismissal exception, says that you can either incorporate the terms of the settlement agreement into the final entry, or you can specifically reserve the right of the court to have jurisdiction to enforce it at a later time. That doesn't require that the agreement itself be filed. I don't think any appellate district requires that.
Was there a motion to enforce the settlement agreement in this case, or just set aside the entry saying it was dismissed without prejudice?
Actually, there were two motions to enforce the agreement here. One was filed by Infinite, who was the paying party, when the parties couldn't agree on who was to get the money.
Filed in the trial court?
Rather than the trial court. The Travelers filed its own motion to have the court decide the priority issue, which we believed was to enforce the settlement agreement entered into.
And both of those motions have been ruled on?
Both were disposed of in October of 2012 by the trial court.
In what fashion?
There was a decision that came out, I believe it was on October 12, 2012.
And what was the result of that?
The result was that the court found that Travelers should receive the settlement funds to be paid by Infinite.
So the underlying facts of this case are resolved, and this is an esoteric issue that you want us to resolve so that trial courts and appellate courts get on one track for resolution of cases involving this kind of journal entry.
Well put.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Van Blarken.
May it please the court. I wanted to answer a couple of the questions that were posed to Travelers in the case first at the outset, and the first question by the Chief Justice with respect to the timing of the dismissal entry in this case and its relation to overage. The settlement conference in the case was held on May 19th, 2011. Mm-hmm. The following day, on May 20th, 2011, the trial court entered an order denying Travelers' motion for leave to amend its complaint and specifically stated in its order that, further, this matter is now overage pursuant to the Ohio Rules of Superintendence. 3 days later, the court entered its dismissal entry. Justice O'Donnell had asked if there had been a motion to enforce, and the response was that there were two motions. We do not see that the second motion in this particular case to decide the apportionment issue was actually a motion to enforce. It was filed as a follow-up to the motion to void out the original dismissal entry, and the court, or the travelers, had asked the court to decide that issue as a quick means to resolve the case. It was not itself a motion to enforce. In fact, travelers never filed a motion to enforce, a specific motion to enforce, in the court below.
Counsel, the problem I have here is, what remedy is therefore left to a party who in good faith settles a claim, dismisses their action, goes on their merry way, and 6 months later finds a very recalcitrant opposing counsel? You can't go back into court because it's res judicata, is it not?
It would be, the settlement itself would be a final resolution of the case. If the proper procedure had been followed and the dismissal entry had been entered with the assistance and consent of the parties rather than a sua sponte dismissal, which we believe was probably improper in this case because there's nothing under the civil rules
that allows it. It didn't work in this case. And
yes,
I'm asking
correct.
You, what remedy, therefore, is somebody who has settled and dismissed, what remedy do they have?
To enforce the settlement agreement.
To get their money.
If there was not an express reservation of jurisdiction, the only remedy would be to file a new case. And that's not new law in Ohio. We're focusing on cases that fall somewhere in between, where there has been a mention of the settlement, and the question is whether or not that's sufficient enough to retain jurisdiction. In cases where there has been no mention of settlement, the clear answer by all of the courts in Ohio is that the only remedy in that particular situation is to file a new action. And that's not new law. That's been Ohio law for at least 30, 40 years.
And then somebody would come in and say, I've got a court and satisfaction. Leave me alone.
Again, that would have to be dealt with in the new action.
Was it your view that the court was anticipating a supplemental entry would be filed by the parties detailing the terms of the settlement agreement?
I believe that the court indicated clearly that that's what was their anticipation was.
And then what happens when the court doesn't get that anticipated entry?
That's part of the problem with what we have and the proposition of law here of setting up a new procedure for allowing placeholder entries. The court thought that its dismissal entry without prejudice was a placeholder entry, a stay of proceedings rather than a true dismissal. And that the unanswered question is, what happens if the parties don't file a new entry? Does the dismissal entry then become a dismissal with prejudice? Does it become a dismissal without prejudice?
Haven't we, through our civil rules, though, defined what dismissal with prejudice is and what dismissal without prejudice
Correct.
Is?
Correct. But what
they're both dismissals.
They're both dismissals.
The court loses jurisdiction in both instances, and the only difference is one party has a right to refile, according to statute of limitations and the other details of that, either within or without on the saving statute.
But exactly. And that is our central theme in this particular case, is that a dismissal is a termination of the court's jurisdiction to act further in the case.
All right. So dismissal now, what is your view then with respect to the certified conflict question?
We believe the court should answer the question in the affirmative and hold that in order to be a conditional dismissal, it must either incorporate the terms of the settlement, and by incorporation, I don't mean that it has to be word for word each term of the settlement, but rather a incorporation of the body of the settlement.
Where are we finding this term conditional settlement or unconditional
arose,
settlement? That's not in our civil rules.
It arose, I believe, by the court's interpretation.
Oh, probably this court.
And yes, and in particular.
We don't make law, but we make up terms. We can do that.
I understand. And I believe it arose from the federal practice. I believe this court followed.
They always get us in trouble.
We urge the court actually to follow the Supreme Court's decision in Kekkonen, and it's consistent with the majority view in this state, the other side has attempted to distinguish, but we believe the central theme of it is correct in this case, that a dismissal terminates the jurisdiction of the court in the federal court system. If there's not additional grounds for jurisdiction after the dismissal, the court has to the court can't rehear and enforce the judgment. In Ohio, it's the same thing in a sense that.
So if we followed or adopted your suggestion, for example, and answered this in the affirmative, then in the next instance coming through, and if a dismissal were entered without prejudice and the settlement fell apart for whatever reason, then one party or another would be obligated to not go to court to enforce the agreement, but to file a new action.
Correct. Well, there's I guess, a split of authority in Ohio with that particular issue with respect to a dismissal without prejudice. There are some cases, and I believe this court ruled on that issue in Hensley, that says that a dismissal without prejudice cannot be overturned by a Rule 60B motion, but the only remedy to a erroneously entered dismissal without prejudice would be to file a new action. There's some additional authority that suggests that in a case where there's a dismissal without prejudice that was erroneously entered, the court still has the inherent authority to go back and reverse that decision.
Do we need to look at Hensley if we?
I believe it's a tangent issue in this particular case. If the court has a central focus of what happens between a dismissal without prejudice and with prejudice, I believe, yes, that would be a case to look at.
Counsel, in a case like this where there seems to be some ambiguity with what the court intended, why does it not make sense that we look to the record and see what the court intended?
As the Sixth District said in its decision, courts should speak through their records, through their orders. And in this particular case, we're talking about a jurisdictional issue. Our position is that, yes, there should be some flexibility whether or not the court retains jurisdiction, but that should be clearly spelled out on the face of the dismissal entry rather than relying on ambiguity, because what ambiguity does in these particular situations is it results in more litigation. The cases that we cited within our brief, the large citation, were all cases where there was not a clear dismissal entry, and the parties wound up, as in this case, in years of litigation over what the court's authority was post-dismissal. A clear and simple statement that the court reserves just jurisdiction. Those simple words would be sufficient to spell out what the court's intent was.
Or, as you said, some indication that some embodiment of the terms of the settlement.
Right.
But you are not asking for word-by-word incorporation of a settlement.
No, Your Honor.
Can you talk about that a little bit more, about
yes.
What do you think embody the terms? What does that mean?
I think it has to be similar to what happens in contracts, where there's an incorporation of some type of agreement or document that's outside the face of the document. That way, what happens is the settlement becomes part of the order. And what the court is doing when it's enforcing jurisdiction is not continuous jurisdiction, which ends at the dismissal, but rather enforcing its order, which includes that particular that settlement agreement.
Does that settlement agreement have to be part of the court record, and is it public?
No, it is not. Incorporation, the express incorporation says that the settlement agreement is part of the order, and it can be incorporated without actually attaching it to the dismissal entry.
So any concerns about confidentiality of settlement terms, you would say, would be remedied by that you could incorporate the terms without making them part of the public record?
Correct. If there was a confidentiality agreement, the confidentiality agreement would be honored. It would still be part of the dismissal entry, but the only people who would have knowledge of it would be the parties, unless there was a dispute actually about what the contract terms were. There is another way under the federal rules and under the majority view, and that's by expressly reserving the jurisdiction. So we don't even have to have a full incorporation. As long as the words, the court retains jurisdiction to enforce the settlement, are included within the body, it shows the clear intent that this case will continue on, that the court is going to reserve that jurisdiction. We had discussed that the statute of limitations for the enforcement of the settlement agreement is how long the court would have jurisdiction.
So the words dismissal without prejudice should really never be used in a situation you're describing.
Without converting dismissals without prejudice into a stay, because essentially the ultimate form of prejudice on a case is a settlement. The settlement precludes the parties from relitigating the issues and is a new binding contract. And as the federal courts instruct us, in order to continue on with a enforcement of that, there has to be separate independent grounds for jurisdiction to enforce the settlement.
And in your view, the dismissal without prejudice always means a refiling, a separate case.
Yes, and we understand that there is some contrary authority to that. We would actually ask the court to revisit Page and look at the particular facts of that case. That was somewhat different in this case, because what we had in that was a dismissal that said we are going to reopen the case. The dismissal was based on a bankruptcy, and the court didn't want the case on its docket during the pendency of the bankruptcy until it was reopened. And the court specifically said in language that we are retaining jurisdiction in this particular case. in order to reopen this case if the bankruptcy is lifted. So when this court looked at that particular case, it construed that as more of a stay of proceedings. I think realistically it's more of a conditional dismissal based on express terms of the bankruptcy rather than that. But we run down a slippery slope of treating these as a stay of proceedings when there are alternative means to actually enforce the case.
As a practical matter, are these dismissals without prejudice being used to avoid problems with reporting requirements?
In this particular case, the evidence suggests that that is what occurred.
But is this a problem throughout the state? That's my question.
The cases, we cited a number in our brief. There's a long string citation of cases which we believe that the dismissal was being used as a placeholder entry. Some of them were with prejudice, and some of them were with without. I believe the case from the 11th District that is certified was a dismissal without prejudice. So that's a suggestion that that might be a possibility in that case. In some ways, it's hard to determine because the facts are not specifically stated how old the case is, et cetera. One of the other issues I wanted to bring up is that we're looking at this, and in the briefs, we looked at this as being exclusively an issue between the parties. But if we are to imply retention of jurisdiction from the language of the contract, it may also impose an unwanted burden upon the courts themselves. The federal law again instructs us that there's no requirement that a court retain jurisdiction to enforce a settlement. In some cases, they may not wish to do so. If we can say that the mere mention of a settlement within the dismissal entry is sufficient to retain jurisdiction, the court may have jurisdiction it never intended to have. Again, we believe that the entry should be clear, that it indicates on its face that the court's intent is to retain that jurisdiction rather than force the courts to hear matters that they did not intend to hear. In closing, Karam respectfully requests that the court answer the certified question in the affirmative and follow the Supreme Court of the United States decision in Kekkonen, as well as the majority of Ohio's appellate districts. Additionally, we would ask the court to reject Traveler's proposition of law as requiring the court to basically invent a new procedure to protect dismissal entries, which in fact would undermine the dismissal without prejudice and treat it as a stay of proceedings. Lastly, if the court finds in favor of Travelers in this case, there were other additional issues that were raised in the 6th District that two other assignments of error, one of them in particular being whether or not the agreement to submit this issue to the court was part of the settlement, and also whether or not the court could reach an issue that was not raised in any of the pleadings in the court below, and in effect bootstrap on a declaratory judgment action in the guise of enforcing the settlement. Therefore, if the court finds in favor of Travelers, we would ask that the court remand this case to the 6th District to decide the two remaining issues.
Thank you. Strickland, you used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
I would ask this court to go back and look at its public policy pronouncements. It seems pretty clear that forcing a party to file a new lawsuit does not promote public policy. Forcing a party to file a new lawsuit to enforce a settlement agreement simply adds delays to the resolution of the dispute, and it adds additional costs to the parties and the litigants.
And doesn't that maybe work to the benefit of having a settlement then actually worked on if they know that the alternative is that they've got to go and pretty much start over?
Well, I think the settlement that's involved in any dismissal, I mean, is worked on and is set in writing at some
point. But I'm just saying there may be more incentive. But it could work either way. You're saying that I don't see it as necessarily a deterrent. Let me put it that way.
I think the deterrent here, it's not a deterrent. I would agree with the court. It's not a deterrent. But what it does is it imposes a burden upon the parties that they shouldn't have to bear, because the trial judge who has jurisdiction over the case in the beginning and who has sat through the pretrials and the discovery and is in the position to have talked to the parties about the settlement, he's in the best position, he or she is in the best position to enforce the settlement agreement once it comes back if it's not being followed by the parties. So it should go back to that judge. It's the most efficient way. It's the fastest way to obtain finality among the parties. Travelers would ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals, that it answer the certified question in the negative, that it adopt its proposition of law, and we agree that the case should be remanded to the Sixth District so that the other issues presented by appellee to that court can be considered. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.